Well, I think we can get started. And I'm wondering here who all was at the concert last night, or the band. Yes, that was great. Three things I liked about that event were, first of all, it was great music. Second of all, because it combined several different world styles of music, it was a reminder that the context in which we're working is an international context. And third of all, what I liked about it was the way the final band wrapped up. They were from Senegal, and they emphasized that we need to all be working toward justice, love, and peace. And I think that those are values that unite us all here at this conference, whether we're coming from business or government or civil society. These values are ones that we need to promote when we're thinking about a sound identity management system. This particular session is an initiative by the Net Dialogue Project, which is graciously funded by the Bradley Foundation. And you may have seen this brief overview of the project. It explains that Net Dialogue seeks to shed light on international net governance, to foster dialogue between technologists and the international policymaking community, and also to work for concrete, practical ways that we might build democratic mechanisms into the architecture of the networked world. On the reverse side of this sheet, there's a brief explanation of what we're going to do in this panel session. Basically, we're covering some international instruments that deal with personal data protection, and then some of the tech tools, and we're going to be asking how can these mutually support each other. Now, we have here Anne Carblanc from the OECD. She's a world-leading expert in the protection of personal data and privacy in international instruments. And I think you may be aware that the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, is an intergovernmental organization joining the world's leading economies. So whatever gets negotiated in the OECD really has an impact for the whole world, and it tends to spread outward for the world. And so I'm going to start with Anne and then let other people introduce themselves as they go.
Okay. It's a more intimate group to a certain extent. It may be easier to have an interactive discussion. The OECD is an intergovernmental body and is going to work on identity management. It's a strategic issue for governments to look at the issuance and the management of identities for citizens as they are moving government activities online. But the OECD has also been, for many years, working in the area of electronic commerce, so governments have also an interest in looking at how businesses would identify and manage the identity of consumers on the web. I am going to make a brief introduction to the international data protection and privacy instruments. There are two major references. One is the OECD privacy guidelines. They date back to 1980. And another one is the Council of Europe Convention, which was adopted at the beginning of 1981. Data protection is a recent area of law, barely more than 30 years. At the origin, it had, and you'll find maybe it's still valid, it was an individual-centric vision. Personal data were considered, and are still considered, as a kind of extension of a person. Personal data cover characteristics, details, that directly or indirectly identify a person. And data protection was designed to frame the development of computer technology at that time. So the principles for data protection are stated in a technology-neutral manner. There are a few differences between the OECD privacy guidelines and the Council of Europe Convention. Both instruments were negotiated in parallel. The OECD guidelines are non-binding. The Council of Europe Convention is binding. That's a difference. And there's more flexibility under the OECD guidelines than there is under the Convention of the Council of Europe. Both instruments, that's interesting, have the same objective. They set the rule of the game at international level. Namely, the objective is to develop, was to develop a common framework, legal framework, a platform, one could say, of protection, the implementation of which would create trust among the different member countries and states, and therefore avoid disruptions in the flow of information across the borders. The reasoning for developing these instruments was like creating a club or a trust circle or a trust seal. The commonalities are at various levels, at the level of the basic principles, and they are valid all throughout the world in national laws. It's all about transparency, fairness, and lawfulness. I have tried to aggregate the principles for data protection in three big categories. The first category could be called minimalism, proportionality, and efficiency. You should collect no more personal data than needed to fulfill your objectives. And you should keep this personal data accurate, complete, and up-to-date, and secure. Security is an important aspect. Second series of principles, information and openness. Others would say disclosure or awareness. You should tell the person who you are and where you are, what information you collect, and why. And you should do that on a one-to-one basis if you collect from the person, or on a one-to-many basis. Examples today of privacy policies, privacy impact assessments respond to the need to inform the public. Third category of principle, responsibility and accountability. We could say keep to your word, no secondary use if no prior disclosure, except by the authority of law. Respond to inquiries by individuals. Do you store personal data about them? Which ones? For what purpose? And are these data accurate and needed? As to the variations between these two instruments, we could say that there are two main differences. One is that the OECD guidelines do not specify any list of sensitive information that requires additional protection, like consent, legal protection, or technical measures, like encryption. The OECD guidelines is very much about the proportionality principle. It will depend on the type of information that you collect and store. By the way, it's an advantage when we come to using biometrics, because in the Council of Europe Convention and in the European Directive, you have a list, which is an exhaustive list of sensitive information, and biometrics are not in there. So you need to make a lot of gymnastics to try to differentiate among biometrics to know which ones should be obtained with consent and which ones could not require consent. The second major difference between the two instruments is about the implementation. The OECD guidelines say that at national level, you may have an independent authority for data protection oversight, or a government agency, or self-regulatory bodies. The Convention of Europe states that you should have an independent authority. Other commonalities include sanctions and remedies in case of non-compliance, mutual assistance and international cooperation, and that's the focus for this panel, limited and legitimate exceptions to the basic principles, in particular for national security and public policy purposes, like monetary interests, law enforcement. In terms of scope, that's the last commonality, these two instruments apply both to the public and the private sector. So the question is, it's a good body of rules, long-standing one. So why is today the issue of user control over one's personal information so central to discussions on IDM systems? It seems that it should be obvious. One option might be that technology has decreased the cost for collecting, storing, mining, matching, exchanging personal data. Public sector finds it easier for law enforcement purposes to store and process information. The private sector finds it easy when they want to profile people and offer them attractive, personalized offers to gain a competitive edge. But one broader impact of the wild and wide collection and storage of personal information by the private sector is that it kind of, in a secondary role, facilitates a secondary use for law enforcement purposes. Why not? Maybe for the good. With respect to IDM systems, there are three important issues that apply to both the public and the private sector, and I'm not sure we have the answer today and even tomorrow. First issue is, will IDM systems facilitate or not access to broader categories of personal data and function creep? I believe that risk and impact assessments will help evaluate the impact of various technologies or applications on security and privacy. We heard a lot about interoperability at technical level. We didn't hear a lot about interoperability at policy level. Second issue, will IDM systems facilitate or not enforcement of user control and consent and accountability? What a consumer or a citizen or a business is authorized to do is one side of the coin. What a civil servant or a business employee is authorized to see, to do, to access regarding a consumer, a citizen, or a business, and how this is audited, this is the other side of the coin. Third issue, what will the trust requirements and the associated costs be for the new IDM systems? Trust is quite complex. Trust comes with in the relation between the consumer, citizen, and the service provider. There is service provider trust issues in user clients and vice versa. There is trust between federated service providers with symmetric and asymmetric trust relationships. Maybe some parties will suffer from higher exposure than others. There is trust in ID mapping, if applicable. There is the service provider trust in credentials providers, the user trust in personal authentication devices, and trust in service provider identity management. Will the service provider have the expected identity? All these issues are issues that the OECD is going to explore and examine and analyze. Today, it seems that IDM systems are at a too early stage of design, but that's also a chance to build in adequate privacy and security protections. Thank you.
Great. Back to me for a second. I'm going to refer to some of the international legal instruments that may represent legitimate government interest in having access to or sharing personal data, and how, if you wouldn't mind changing slides as we go along. As you see, a list of five different types of instruments, reasons why government might have a legitimate interest in having access to data are here: cybercrime, taxation, travel, money transfers, and the environment. For the Convention on Cybercrime, which is the next slide, this is an initiative by the Council of Europe, including 45 European countries, as well as the United States, South Africa, Canada, and Japan. And it basically calls for common definitions of what constitutes cybercrime, procedures for enforcement, and international cooperation. They call for a fast and effective regime for sharing information. In terms of the personal data dimensions, the identity management aspect, it may cause some of you concern here that it does call for governments to be empowered to order the expedited preservation of data, order service providers to give over that data, and also search or access computer systems and stored data. So if companies are wanting in this system to allow people to feel that their data is going to be protected, they should bear in mind these provisions. Another initiative on the next slide is one by the International Civil Aviation Organization, and it concerns machine-readable travel documents. Many of you in here may have heard of those. They're the ones that call for RFID chips in passports and other travel documents that would contain biometric information, and this would be a sort of global standard for communicating this information. So in terms of identity management, you can see that there would be aspects there. Maybe these same tools would be employed in facilitating the exchange of data by officials at border checkpoints and such. The next initiative concerns taxation. This is another initiative by the OECD. It's the e-commerce taxation framework. And it's clear that different jurisdictions would want to iron out a common approach for dealing with taxation issues so that there's not double taxation and those sorts of problems that would be encountered in international commerce. But here again, in order to know that kind of information on who's doing what kinds of transactions, the governments might want access to specific contract information, secure access to reliable and verifiable information to identify taxpayers. On the next slide, we have recommendations on terrorist financing by the Financial Action Task Force. These are basically designed to combat money laundering, again, a legitimate government interest. The interesting thing here, though, is that all information, all funds transfers are subject to these provisions. So if you're doing just your everyday financial transfer, presumably they fall under these recommendations. And the final one is the Global Earth Observation System of Systems. This is a new group, or this is a new initiative by a new group called the Group on Earth Observations. And the idea is to just tie together all the different systems that collect data about the Earth. But there's no real limitation on what this particular endeavor among governments could cover. And in fact, it even says that socioeconomic data might be the type of data that could be collected and exchanged. And if you look at trends over time, just over the last 15 years, you can see that we've gone from a system that looks at activities of suspected criminals only to one that's covering your average citizen today, or unusual activities, communications dealing with crime, to your everyday activities. And then here again, not just international activities, but activities within a home country. So these may be legitimate government interests, but at the same time, we may need to question them and take them into account as we're looking at a good system for identity management. Now it's to Hugh.
Okay. Actually, my comments, I feel like, and now for something completely different, my comments follow maybe more on Anne's in the commercial space first, at least. My name is Hugh Stevenson. I've been a fellow here at the law school this year studying international comparative privacy laws and international consumer protection and privacy enforcement. I'm on leave from the Federal Trade Commission, where I head the division that deals with the international aspects of privacy and consumer protection issues. I guess what I'd like to talk about just briefly is taking the sort of context, the stage that's set by Anne about the basic principles that exist, the OECD privacy principles and the like, and subject to the various sorts of qualifications in certain contexts that Mary has talked about, and think about how those apply, because I think one of the challenges, how do those kinds of principles apply? And let's take two contexts. How do they apply in the context of the user perspective, the user experience, and how do they apply in terms of the global context, the global perspective of crossing borders, since, as I think both my colleagues mentioned, there is a cross-border element to a lot of this. What is this kind of experience, the screen experience that the user has in dealing with this kind of system? In the previous session, Mike Jones from Microsoft had showed the mock-up, which I think a number of people have seen, of their particular application. And it's interesting, he said it was an intentionally limited channel of interactions. But I think it's important to think about what the channel of interactions are that the consumer or the users have there in terms of making both how they make informed choices and what kind of choices there are available to choose from. In terms of the process issue, as Anne says, one of the basic principles in a lot of the OECD and other international guidelines is transparency, that it's clear what it is that the person is choosing to do and what it is that is happening to the kind of information they have. What are the potential issues that an information identity management system raises in that context? And I would just suggest a couple to think about, and a lot of these I think have already come up in the course of discussion so far. On the one hand, one of the complicating factors is that there may be several parties and several privacy practices or policies that the consumer has to be aware of that need to be communicated to the person doing the choosing about what happens to their information. You have the system providing the identity management system. You have, as talked about in the previous session, the identity brokers, issuers, providers who may have policies about their information, and maybe they have a fiduciary responsibility or see themselves as having a fiduciary responsibility, or maybe they don't, as someone raised in a question. On the other hand, this limited channel of interaction raises the opportunity to make the experience more comprehensible, more meaningful to the person doing the choosing. What is happening to the information that I'm sending? I guess a point to emphasize here, and I think that Anne also emphasized, is that the focus is not just on, well, what information am I sending, but it's also, well, what is it that happens to that information generally when I send it? It's not just, I just sent my name, or I just sent this string of data, but what generally is happening? Where is it going? Who is getting it? How is it being used? And having this limited channel of interaction provides the opportunity, someone said previously, the consistent user experience. The steering wheel is always on the same side. And why is that helpful from the user point of view is that you're trying to communicate very efficiently to someone what privacy choices they are making so that they can make those choices. It's meaningful to them, but they're not presented with a blizzard, a text blindness, a whole lot of text. Somebody's suggesting you scroll down at the end, it says, "We control the world." You don't have a whole lot of text there, but you have something that simplifies the process, and sometimes less can be more in terms of communicating not only efficiently but effectively to people. One analogy I just point out to this is some of the work done, and actually I think the OECD is also looking at this, in the area of, I guess, what's usually called short order or short form of notices, where the goal is to take the sort of long legal screed and say, let's turn this into something that is short, punchy, really hits at the most relevant points so that it's meaningful, so that people can make meaningful choices about what's happening for their information. They might, obviously it may be available if you click through to get more information, but one of the challenges is also, what is really the net impression that someone's coming away with as to what's happening here with my data? Remember, it's a limited channel of interaction. You have limited sort of attention that people typically may pay to this. How do you make it so that what you get their attention for in terms of what will happen to their data is meaningful? This kind of channel of interaction also provides the opportunity, I think, and worth thinking about, of what kind of choices are you aggregating together? Because one of the challenges in making meaningful notice and meaningful choice to people is that it's worth their time to think about it, look at it. To the extent that it is all atomized, that you have to make lots and lots and lots of little privacy choices, it's harder to get people to do that as a matter of policy. People are less interested. If there are ways of aggregating meaningful choices, that's something to consider. One analogy there might be, we at the FTC worked on the do not call list for telemarketing. And before, if you had the choice of saying, I don't want you to call me, 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 the challenge there was it was a lot of transactional time for consumers, for people to deal with that. If I can say, you know what, I don't want any of you to call me, can combine the sort of privacy choice, empower somebody to make a larger choice. Or I want no one to call me except you and you, or I want everyone can call me except you and you, and making it more a more meaningful, more powerful choice. Because I think one of the issues is transparency, as Anne mentioned, and part of that is, well, how do you make it so that somebody doesn't just in theory have kind of a choice, but it's a system that promotes meaningful choice. One of the, I think, related issues there also is, though, that there's a tension, because in a sense, these systems are setting up a kind of agent, if you will, or agents, I suppose, to do things for you. It's a limited interactive channel. It's trying to simplify, to streamline what you have to do to make these decisions. And there is a tension then in that. If it doesn't really streamline that process, what have you gained? You want it to empower you. On the other hand, one has to keep an eye on whether you are really empowering your agent to do what you have asked the agent to do, or whether, in a sense, the agent is going off and doing things that you either haven't authorized or didn't realize you were authorizing it in that kind of context, or didn't understand you were doing at all. And I think those are the kinds of questions to ask in terms of thinking about what is the user perspective in terms of the process with the goal of making an informed, a meaningful choice in a transparent context. On the substance of it, what choices or what options do you end up choosing from? I think these points are raised, and I think Bill McGovern raised them in his panel yesterday, but there are the questions of what, how do you set the system up so there is, in fact, meaningful competition and a meaningful number of providers of iBrokers, iIssuers, but at the same time, how do you address the trust issue in going to those providers, in getting people to use those providers with some assurance that they know what is going to happen to the information that you are giving them so that they can give to others. So that those are a couple of comments on the user perspective. And then to zoom out to the global perspective, there is this challenge of legal interoperability, I think, is a term I think Mary has used, of systems. As she said, we all, you know, agree on, it's sort of like the application of these principles, we all agree on, what the band said, we all agree on love, peace, and justice, but, you know, how we apply that in context, it can vary. And there are differences in terms of the legal regimes, obviously, between different countries. And while there are these general principles out there, there are also differences summarized in one New York Times article. It was called Europe Zips Lips, U.S. Sells Zips. Captures, you know, there are different sort of approaches in attitudes to how much information should flow around. And the challenge of that legal interoperability, I think, involves both. Is there an ability to build a platform that can be used in countries and jurisdictions that make different choices? And also, are there ways in which that system can be used to enforce either legal choices or policy choices? And some of the implementation of some of the privacy principles is not necessarily done by statute, by law in some countries, but maybe done other ways. So those are some thoughts on how to look at this, both from the user point of view and the global one. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, so I'm Ben Adida. I'm a graduate student. I should say I'm in the last throes of my PhD at MIT, and I study cryptography as applied to public policy. And I've been for a number of years now a student of the concept that code is law. So I think about the fact that a lot of the code we create, including the code that we're creating in this conference and in the various efforts that are represented here, is going to determine a lot of the policies and a lot of the behaviors that people have online. So I want to make three points. And that one up there is my last point, but you can wonder why it's in Chinese while I make these three points. The first point is that in security, we like to say that attacks always get better. They never get worse. As we attack a system, it's not like we can do less tomorrow than we can do today. We can always break more tomorrow than we can break today. And think of that from the privacy protection standpoint. there will always be more privacy disclosures about you. Once information is disclosed, it's disclosed. It doesn't get put back into the bottle. So the first point is your privacy protection only decreases over time. The second point is, code is law, there are no truly neutral technology platforms. As hard as we try as technologists to make platforms that are neutral from a policy standpoint, they always cause certain choices and behaviors to go in a certain direction. And since privacy always decreases, that means that if we build a platform without thinking strongly about privacy, then and we make it very convenient to send our information to various identity providers or various relying parties, we're going to hasten this release of private information. So there are choices we have to make. There, are, it's not like we can ignore these choices. And I don't want to knock on Microsoft because I think they've created a fantastic opportunity. I only want to push on them and on other providers of these technologies to say there are still choices to be made. And these choices to be made as to what kind of protocols the identity providers will support, whether they will support anonymous credentials, whether that will be truly part of the solution, will have an enormous impact on whether these systems help protect privacy, help conform to these various guidelines from the OECD, or help break them. So we have a platform, but there are still plenty of technical decisions to be made, and these technical decisions will have an enormous impact. The world could be very good for privacy or very bad for privacy based on the platforms we're developing today. But at the same time, there's an enormous opportunity because for whatever reason, although identity has been on people's minds since the beginning of the internet, there is a drive right now to implement a bunch of these technologies, to deploy a lot of these technologies. There's going to be this info card space, system in XP and in Vista in most of the deployed clients out there. That's an opportunity. And the opportunity is one of interoperability, but not the interoperability, I don't think, that we've been talking about. I think the opportunity is for interoperability of the user interface. We're creating what Hugh yesterday referred to as a magic moment of authentication, where we all recognize when we're interacting with our computer, aha, now comes an identity transaction. And it always looks the same. And that is an opportunity because in that transaction, we can start to build things like notices about privacy. And we can start to think about notices about privacy in ways that are interoperable. So the two interoperabilities I'm interested in are, one, the interoperability of user interfaces. Whether I'm using Windows or Mac, any version, I understand. This is now an authentication transaction. This is now an identity transaction. And two, the metadata properties of the fields I'm exchanging need to be interoperable across these systems so that eventually, like Hugh was saying, we need to provide shorter notices for people. Eventually, we can provide notices like Creative Commons does for their licenses so that when you see this Creative Commons license, it's in Chinese, but you see the buy icon and you know that license means it's asking for attribution. And if we use this opportunity of the interoperability, the user interface interoperability of the identity transaction, and we think about the interoperability of the properties and the data and the policies of the data collectors to educate the user at that magic moment of authentication, then we can do, I think, some really interesting things within this framework to help protect users' privacy. But we haven't made these decisions yet. And so the jury's still out on whether these platforms will help privacy or will hurt them. So that's it.
Okay, so I'm Hal Abelson, and this is Danny Weitzner, and we're here, I guess, wearing the hat of the Decentralized Information Group, which is a joint project of the MIT Computer Science Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and the World Wide Web Consortium that does research around data aggregation related to the semantic web. A lot of these discussions about data protection and privacy are founded in the idea that what we're trying to do is somehow restrict access to data. And Danny and I are going to present an alternate perspective. So data restriction is really tough. And it's getting tougher because it flies in the face of a fundamental dynamic of networks that some people refer to as Gingell's Law, after Rob Gingell, who used to be chief scientist at Sun. And Gingell's Law says that the way that networks create value is by a process of fragmenting information, filtering it, and recombining it in new ways, a process of decomposition, filtering, redistribution, and reintegration. And that's the fundamental dynamic that we're all using on the web to create value. We don't have separate telephone book directories. We have specialized information about the people who live in Dubuque who like to eat Chinese food. And when we think about data protection, we're flying in the face of that dynamic. So in other words, we don't want to think of the web as a collection of discrete databases that we're controlling access to. The web is one giant database that can be correlated and aggregated almost limitlessly across multiple sources. The web's already like that to some extent, and it's becoming more so as access to the web becomes increasingly automated. Now, in a world like that, which is maybe what the world is now and maybe what the world is becoming, it's extremely difficult to have data restriction and access control. So let's imagine, as an extreme, a world where we simply cannot have data access control. We can argue whether that's our present world or whether our world is becoming like that, but it's a useful extreme to think about. And now the question is, what could we do instead? So the basic point that we want to make today is that we should have policies and technologies that are aimed at usage limitation as opposed to access control. In other words, we want to create policies and technologies that try to guarantee that data is used appropriately, even if we can't restrict access to data, and arrange that if harm is done, then there can be redress. Now, what that means from a policy and technology perspective is that we need two things. One is transparency. We need to be able to know what happened, where data came from, where it flowed. And the second one is accountability. Accountability means that there are rules associated with data use, and we can either manually or automatically check whether those rules were followed. And we call this infrastructure the policy-aware web. Namely, information has policies associated with it, the policies are machine-readable, and the infrastructure can know whether or not the policies were followed. Now, that all must sound pretty abstract, so let me show you an example. So this is an example. Everyone was talking about security. This is an example from airline flight security. So let's imagine that Joseph Berkman Smith, who lives on Mass Ave in Cambridge, boards a flight from Boston to LaGuardia. Now, what happens in the current infrastructure is the airline's going to create a passenger name record. That's going to be sent to the Transportation Safety Authority to match it against suspects on the no-fly list with the aid of some commercial data. And let's imagine that the TSA now finds a match to Joseph Berkman Smith. In fact, Joseph Berkman Smith, who happens to live in New York, on Main Street in New York, and now signals the FBI and says, "Tell us what you know about this guy, Joseph Berkman Smith." The FBI does a search through its various databases and finds out that in New York, there is a deadbeat dad warrant against our Cambridge resident, Joseph Berkman Smith, fleeing interstate to avoid payment of a debt, of a child support debt, is a crime, and Joseph Smith is arrested. So that's all completely true data going on. However, this is not a valid arrest. The reason it's not a valid arrest is because the TSA is restricted in sending data to stuff that is relevant to counterterrorism, and deadbeat dad is not counterterrorism. Now, let's imagine a piece of infrastructure that would aid that. You can imagine someone challenging this. This might be a piece of infrastructure used by a judge who's reviewing the record. It might be done by an inspector general. And the machine has looked at this record and concluded that the arrest is not justified. So you can find all sorts of things that are happening. There was a, who was the arresting official? The arresting official was somebody in the FBI. It's not too interesting. But the machine has come up with an automated conclusion that says the arrest is unjustified because the charge that he is, the offense he's charged with is not a permissible use of the data on which it was based. Now, why is that true? Well, we can ask for more explanation. The charge is failure to pay child support obligations. He was arrested. Where did the basis for the arrest come from? Well, the arrest came from an open source search. The search revealed a warrant, and there we can look at the warrant. Where that search result came from? Well, that search result came from another thing, which is a search. What caused that search? Well, that search came from an investigation that was opened by the FBI. What caused that investigation to be opened? Well, there was a transfer of data, in this case from the TSA. The purpose for that data transfer was counterterrorism, and so on and so on and so on. And the machine can go back and trace whether that data was used appropriately. So this thing I'm showing you was automatically generated. What was it automatically generated based on? Well, two sorts of things. One was machine markup of this record of events. So it knows what an arrest is, it knows what the FBI is, it knows what the TSA is. It knows that use of data from the Secure Flight database, it can only be transferred for the purpose of counterterrorism. Second thing that the machine has is encoding of the rules and policies. So it knows, for example, that deadbeat dad violation is not counterterrorism. And together with the encoding of the rules and policies, it has some automated deduction techniques. So it can know that if data flows for the purpose of counterterrorism, then the subsequent events must be counterterrorism. Okay, so that's a tiny example of what kinds of tools might exist in the world when you talk about tracking appropriate use. So marking up events, building automated reasoning techniques to see whether policies were followed. In other words, another way to say this is that we talk about data protection, but that might not be the right word. So you know that in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, there's this fundamental Supreme Court decision where Potter Stewart writes, the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. And similarly, we might want to talk about a privacy regime in which our policies protect people, not data. And that, if we did that, that might create a fundamental shift in the way that we look at a lot of these issues. So to imagine what that world might look like more extensively, let me turn it over to Danny.
I don't know how much more extensive I can say than to cite Potter Stewart. I want to just start with one quick caveat. As Hal said, this is work that is informed very much by web infrastructure development that we're doing at the World Wide Web Consortium and research that we're doing in our research group at CSAIL. This is decidedly research work. We don't think that we're ready to standardize or even come close to standardize this. We started this work with one fundamental question in mind. We wanted to try to look at the way that we see web technology developing, information technology developing in general, and ask what can that teach us about how we ought to be thinking about privacy law and how we can actually protect our fundamental privacy values. Perhaps a little bit in contrast to Ben, probably not too much, but a little bit. I'm actually increasingly, the more I look at this technology, I'm increasingly of the school That says law is law, code is not law, law is law. The problem is that sometimes law doesn't interact all that well with code. It doesn't play as well with code as you would like. So you have to be careful about how you construct law so that it interacts the way that you want it to interact with code to produce the desirable results. I think we have a lot to learn from the code is law perspective, but we also have to really keep in mind the fundamental kinds of privacy values that we're trying to protect and understand how to do that given the code that's out there. I think sometimes we have the opportunity to change code. Other times we have the opportunity to change law. I actually, having been involved in both trying to change laws and trying to change code at the level of the architecture of large things like the internet and the web, I'm sort of coming to the view that it's actually easier to change law. I think that the key insight that we've been able to gather so far from this experience, from looking around at the web and how web technology is evolving, is first and foremost, as I said, the need to really focus on what does, as I think Hugh said, what is meaningful privacy protection mean? And I tend to think in sort of very shorthand terms that privacy, information privacy, comes down to two things. It comes down to making user choice practical. Not pretending that if we give people long agreements or whether they're machine readable or otherwise that they'll be able to make choices. I think that we look around at the culture and we see the culture of the use of information systems, and we see that people are making a lot of choices about disclosing a lot more information. We should not from that assume that people therefore don't care about fundamental privacy values, and we should not assume that just because, as Hal suggested, information is out in the open, it means you can do anything you want with it. And I think that the environment that we're trying to create here, both technically and legally, is an environment where we can understand the interaction between fundamental privacy rules and information that's out there, whether it's disclosed or not, whether it's held by one person or one party or not. The key, I want to just make one very quick point and then get to a discussion. The key switch that we're really trying to promote here, technically you saw, is one that promotes transparency both of the facts used to reach conclusions about people, reach what is called in the Fair Credit Reporting Act context, facts that are used to reach adverse consequences. We want transparency both of facts and transparency of rules, what the actual rules are, and transparency of the reasoning process. And then we want to be able to apply accountability to be able to assess whether the rules in any given case actually were followed. I think that what we see in the case of a lot of privacy policies and a lot of privacy laws, frankly, is rules that are written in rules or policies that are written in such a generic manner at such a high level of granularity that people don't really have meaningful choices, and the rules don't even enforce anything particularly meaningful in terms of privacy principles. So I think we're hoping to learn from this exercise of actually taking lots of different privacy rules, both real and imagined or hoped for, what level of granularity we actually have to start writing privacy laws. We're able to analyze and draw inferences from information at such an enormously increasing level of specificity, and frankly, the rules about what kinds of inferences we consider acceptable legally or even culturally just haven't kept pace. So we need to kind of escalate the level of specificity of privacy rules, and then I think we need to put in the hands of individuals, of citizens, and of governments and courts in some cases, tools to be able to assess compliance with those rules. And there are two fundamental modes that we've identified about this kind of rule compliance. One mode is what you might call a kind of after-the-fact compliance. It's the kind of thing that you see in the way that the Fair Credit Reporting Act works in the United States. You got denied a loan, and then you say, oh, darn, and you're able to go back and figure out, hopefully, why. That's not a system that works perfectly, but it actually works reasonably well given the enormous volume volume of information in the credit system. And the second mode that would be applicable to the example that Hal showed is a mode that says that we recognize, on the one hand, that governments have increasing power in criminal and national security investigations, dramatically increasing power to data mine, to conduct inferences, and we seem to at this point culturally be accepting the fact that we want governments to have that power. But I would suggest that what we've learned is that it's possible at the same time to increase the level of accountability to rules, that we can actually, through systems of the sort that we've just kind of developed at a toy level, frankly, here, we could actually expect that when governments deploy these very, very intrusive kinds of inferencing systems, that they actually ought to be able to prove upon the use of that inference that the inference was justified according to the rules. Not just assert that it's justified, not just go to a judge and say, yeah, you should arrest this guy, but actually present a proof, a logical proof that says, here's the information I have, here's where I got it from, here's why it complies with the rules. And I think that We've always been in a mode, especially in the interaction between advances in information and communication technology on the one hand, and increases in surveillance power. We've always been in a mode where we've said we have to continually increase the level of privacy protection that we have, the level of regulation of government use of personal information. We have to increase it commensurate with the power that the government has to do surveillance. And we think that the next step in that increase is going to come by actually requiring a logically based, provable accountability to rules that are specific enough to actually enforce the kind of restrictions and fundamental privacy rights that we care about. Now, that's in some sense the easy part. The hard part is probably to figure out what level of privacy intrusions and protections we're actually comfortable with as societies. We actually have to figure out what these rules are. We can't wave our hands at them. We can't, as I think a lot of us, myself included, did in the 90s, say, let's just give people choice. I think that what we've learned is that the choices are in many cases too complex. So at minimum, we need to provide a lot of machine assistance for people in making choices. But I would suggest as well that we have basic decisions to make about where we draw lines, about what choices people have to expend energy and effort to make versus what choices and what limitations are going to be protected by public law. The role of law very often is to relieve people of burdens of individual negotiations and individual transactions for public good. And I think we're clearly at the point in privacy where we have to set some of those rules so that people don't have to go around negotiating them individually. We know people don't do it, and we shouldn't from that conclude that that's because they don't care. We should decide that in response to this increasing intrusive power, which is also a very productive power in many, many respects, culturally, commercially, et cetera, that we also increase the level of protection and have this kind of accountability against those rules. So thanks very much.
Well, that sounds terrific. Why don't we take some questions now? The first one I saw to go up was Mark Rottenberg's hand in the back.
Thanks, Mary. I'm going to say something maybe a little bit unpopular, particularly with my friends on this panel, but I'm frankly disappointed. Unless I'm in the wrong room, this panel was titled Identity and Universal Human Rights. But there was really almost no discussion of universal human rights. Anne told us a bit about the OECD privacy guidelines, which is helpful, and Hugh said a few words as well, but beyond that, we actually didn't have a discussion about human rights. So I'd like to begin by reading Article 12 from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's only two sentences. It was endorsed by 140 countries after the Second World War. It said simply, "No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interferences or attacks." Now, that language can be found in dozens of national constitutions, and I can name at least half a dozen international human rights instruments that use similar language. And the European Union, in the recent effort to establish a constitution for the 21st century, paid particular attention to the need to upgrade the principle of privacy and human rights in our modern era, focusing on issues related to data protection and identity. So my question, and really my challenge for this panel, since I think this is actually quite an extraordinary conference and a very good gathering of experts here on this panel, is to kind of take up the question that was presented to you. Do we need a new human rights norm for personal identification? If we were to craft a provision in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for the 21st century, is there any reason that we wouldn't give similar recognition to the rights of individuals to control their identity as the UN tried to do 60 years ago for the rights of individuals to control their privacy and their family, home, and correspondence?
Didn't Bush fire the executive order to restrict all human rights in America?
All the more reason.
I'll take a first crack. Anne, did you want to?
Go ahead.
I'll take a first crack. So I guess, Mark, you summarized that provision in a somewhat different way than I think you read it. You summarized it as the right of individuals to control their identity. What I heard that provision, the way I understand that provision to read is granting rights against I'm sure there was somewhere an unreasonable qualifier on the intrusion on those rights. And I think that so I guess I don't think this is a little bit like the proposal for the protection of constitutional rights on the internet. Could have been made in this room 15, 20 years ago. I don't actually think we need a new statement of principle at that level. I think what we've learned is that we need a much more precise statement of what those principles mean in specific cases, and we have to be very serious about making rules that speak to the types of intrusions that are now possible through the sort of information analysis techniques that are available. My interest is in getting very precise about those kinds of rules, and to actually assume that the provision that you read applies as much to the internet and information and anything else in the 20th century or 21st century as it did at any other point in any other medium. I just don't think that's true. I mean, it would be nice if that were true, but if that's just not the way I understand the enforcement of human rights around the world. I'm interested in enforcement and accountability to particular rules. I think that you're right that people might say that there's obviously universal principles, but I just don't think that they're. I don't think it makes sense to pretend that they're principles that are applied without exception. They just aren't. They're which?
Well, thank you, Mark, for raising that point, and I'm sorry there was some editing challenges to the description of this panel, but you're absolutely right. We should have started with that particular article, and also that raises the question that is in the Code as Law book about what does arbitrary interference mean in a context of today's digital environment? And Anne wants to add.
I wonder if it's the right moment to raise my two challenging points for this audience. You're right, Mark, but are we talking about human rights versus identity? It might be the case. I'm just going to give you two examples, which are just some kind of witnessing of what I saw during my professional experience. One is that we've been hearing a lot of statements like, why worry if you have nothing to hide? This has been a commonplace for several years to, in fact, justify the broad collection and the long-standing storage of information. My question is, has this or does this reveal a societal change, for instance, with respect to the presumption of innocence? The information can be kept because sometimes, someday, it may prove useful. So we can all potentially break the law. That's one thing. The second remark is about the default position. When you look at your situation with respect to information technologies, communications technologies, we are still, at this moment, making a decision to connect. The default is that we are not connected. But we are all working, you more than us, but at the OECD, we are working on the policy issues that are going to come with RFID sensors, pervasive sensors, when we will be, maybe, in an environment and always on. In such a case, will the default change? That means we will always be connected and we will need to make a decision in order not to be connected. And shall we be able to disconnect? And these two issues are about, in a broad sense, identity. Are we losing our point de repère? Sorry.
Reference
points. Reference points, thank you. Do we need somewhere a broad political statement of what matters, whether this should be subject to, you know, an addition to the Human Rights Convention, or whether this should be stated at some level? I agree with you, that's a question, but that's a very difficult question.
Ben?
Yeah, I want to just add a very brief statement to what Mark said. I can't speak as to whether a new formulation of that universal human right is necessary, but I think that even if it happened, even if we made it more precise, there would still be a huge need to involve the user in the decision of providing certain data to data collectors because they're doing so for a certain purpose, which means that to me, the way to respect the spirit of the human right has to go by, has to include the way we build the architecture of the code. It has to include the way that the users choose to give up some of that data. So I believe one way to achieve that human right is by thinking carefully about the architecture of the code, too.
Yes, in the yellow shirt.
So two comments. First, I'm a strong proponent of the whole info card concept, but I've heard this analogy now of the steering wheels always on the same side twice, and it actually struck in my mind, we need to be careful because actually it isn't. In other countries, it's on the other side. So I think there are implications potentially too. Yeah, it makes perfect sense to us. Does it make perfect sense to all of the world? And the second observation is that I sort of object a little bit to the statement that Hal made that says maybe we ought to look at this from a different perspective. My perspective, our company's perspective, is that what you're talking about is sort of the audit trail and accountability, but that happens after the security breach has already happened. We protect our data as a company, and it's not sufficient to say, well, if we know where all our data went, then we're okay. So we really need to solve the data protection problem. If the data doesn't get out, then we don't have a problem. Certainly, it would be nice to have audit trails after the fact, but you have to solve the first problem or your security's failed.
Well, actually, I'd say the opposite. I'd say that you need to solve the problem of how do you provide redress when harm is done so that when your security systems fail, you know what to do. Right? Security's hard, and it's getting harder.
Well, but that almost sounds like you're saying, well, let's spend our energy on the redress side, not solving the protection side. And my job is to solve the protection side. I understand there are failures, so you kind of got to work both, but
it's true that you need both. And I presented an extreme to say the security doesn't exist to counter what I think is the extreme that says if we can simply pretend we can provide data restriction and data security, then that's a solution to the problem. It's not.
And I think Anne wanted to add something.
Yeah, is there any way to prevent the problem and attach to the personal information rights so that when you disclose this information, I don't know, there is some action that prevents them from being, in fact, reused?
So I think that's digital rights management, which is something that's coming but is still in its infancy. But I think that's the whole concept of digital rights management.
Yes. Actually, maybe before your question, Hugh would like to add something.
Okay. There are a couple of thoughts from what people had said. Just, and maybe it's clear to most people, but I think sometimes there's been talk about data protection and then data protection. Data protection has in the legal sphere, is attached to is a sort of body of law, and particularly in Europe, focusing on the legal rules, if you will. I mean, maybe this is the sort of code versus law thing, but, and then I think some of our conversation about data protection has been protecting data, you know, IT people protecting data. There is that kind of difference. In terms of the focus on harm that Hal had mentioned, and maybe in response to your question, I mean, I think that the instruments contemplate both addressing the concerns about what happens up front and what happens later. And Hal's comments reminded me of the there are also privacy guidelines done by APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, which covers the sort of Pacific Rim countries, that really built on the OECD guidelines. And two of the things that were really highlighted there, though, one is the focus on exactly on the prevention of harm, on how do you address vehicles that really try to deal with those issues, and for example, addressing misuse of data and those kinds of issues. And the other issue that one finds particularly highlighted in APEC is accountability, which is also an issue that the folks had raised in terms of the process after, which may not be to denigrate also trying to address what happens before, and that maybe both approaches could be consistent. Mark had raised the issue about the whether new fundamental rights are necessary, and I guess I certainly wasn't thinking nearly big enough, clearly, on the subject of the panel is focused on that. One thing to highlight there, though, is that there is a difference in terms of, in particular, between Europe and the United States on the scope of the rights. Mark was reading, I think, from the UN provision on privacy. There is, in Europe, also in the EU Charter, a separate provision that addresses protection of data or data protection, and that has been viewed, there is a development there of viewing that doctrine of law as involving fundamental rights. Another vehicle that built on the, as Anne mentioned, the binding Council of Europe, which dates back to the 50s, I guess, is the various countries enacted data protection laws, and then the European Union has its own directive on data protection in the legal sense. And so there is this larger question, which I think is sort of cosmic to get into, but important, but of whether that there is that difference in the approaches.
I think, is your name Joseph? Or I'm sorry, in the front
Joaquin.
Row? Joaquin. Oh, Joaquin, sorry. I'm trying to read your name tag.
Oh, sorry. I like this example of the poor guy who was arrested falsely, and I'm sure if a judge saw that record, he would not only release the guy, order his release, but also give him a half an hour head start against the process servers and bounty hunters that would be right outside the courthouse. So that's really great. But along those lines, I like the idea of keeping records of what's happened in order that the individual can have those records available to protect themselves when they get into a bind. And so I thought some of the people on the panel might be interested in following up on something which I believe to be true, although not from examining the code or playing with the code as a user, but only because I've been told this is true. In the Microsoft InfoCard system, there is a log, I think it has a different name, of everything that's done by the card space system. I'm trying to correct my vocabulary. And it's my understanding that it is designed to be technically impossible for the user to see that record. So the expressions on some of the faces indicate that maybe some people will be interested in following up to see if that is actually true. It would certainly be less than the user would like to have.
Yes, in the back, please.
I want to address Mark's as is are my want to address Mark's comment about the need for a new universal human right for identity. I think the difference in talking about some things like privacy, which really are where protection of privacy involves one party, you have to remember. I run the risk here of repeating my comments from yesterday. Identity, at least as we've been talking about it, not in a Jungian sense, identity as in a use sense, really has two parties to it, the person asserting claims and the counterparty. And to the extent that we're going to talk about asserting new human rights over one side to that equation, we have to take into account the rights on the other side. And one has to then question whether there's a right then to reduce my own risk in dealing with you, whether it's a social transaction or otherwise, to ask for identity data. And then the second thing is, and particularly in the United States, where there is the First Amendment, once I learn something from you appropriately in a transaction, whether you can actually prevent me from teaching that to another person. In other words, do I not have a universal right to express your reputation, or at least my view of your reputation or my view of your identity? And that's where it gets a little bit complicated. I think that, you know, to the extent that you go down that path, you really have to get into some real definitional issues about what you mean. If you only mean the personal identifiable information that goes into making up an identity, then, as you know, I'm on your side.
Very interesting. Mark?
I don't know that I need the mic, but I just wanted to make two quick comments, and I appreciate the remarks that others have made. Maybe I didn't frame the question or the early comment quite correctly. What I was really trying to describe in the human rights field was a notion of an evolving characterization of a right. In other words, the United Nations described privacy in a certain way in the late 1940s. The European Union and its Charter of Rights and Freedom just a few years ago described privacy in a new way as protection of personal data, which is actually quite remarkable in an international human rights document. And the question I was really posing to the panel was, do we understand an evolving right of privacy that captures the notion of identity? Because it's clearly become so important that we're all gathered here at this conference to talk about the technology and law and public policy of identity. Now, to at least get a little traction, a foothold on this point without trying to answer it, it is clearly the case that with respect to constitutional law in the United States, we have a right of anonymity. The Supreme Court has said so in four major decisions, which is obviously linked to a notion of controlling the disclosure of identity. So I guess the question that I'm asking, and I think, you know, for some people here, this is actually a very interesting area to pursue, is what would a new right of privacy linked to identity look like if we were talking about human rights norms as generally understood? It won't answer, you know, Danny's very fair question about what does that mean at the detail or implementation level, but that wasn't the attempt of Article 12 when the United Nations set it out after World War II either. I mean, countries had to figure out for themselves, courts, scholars, and everybody else, what it might mean. But I do think there's an extraordinary moment here, I don't know if it's at this conference or somewhere else, to try to answer this question. What is the human rights norm of identity in the 21st century?
Yes, Stefan.
Just for information, there are experiences and development activities in Europe aiming to develop a platform for privacy-enhancing identity systems. We don't know exactly how things are going to evolve, but as I said earlier at the beginning, governments, especially in Europe, are considering moving online. They want to provide several services through one portal or one single sign-on to citizens. And the day where there will be some technology that will be privacy enhancing, that will be identity enhancing, and that will allow to enforce, that's the term which is used in those development initiatives, enforce the privacy rights, then it will be used all across Europe between governments. It may have an impact on business. And I can give you the references of... Yeah, for the moment, it's an area for research and development in Europe. It's funded by the European Commission. It's not only European Commission technocrat and technical people and legal experts. It's also companies. Many of the companies represented here are participating in GUIDE and PRIME, and we'll see what it's going to come up with. But they have a platform. They are developing. They are testing. And they say they will deliver something. So...
Bill, and then Ira, did you?
Can I just answer Stefan and Mark very quickly? Mark, I understand your question better now. Thank you. It seems like your question is almost, what does identity have to do with privacy? You assume it does, and I think it does. But I think it's not easy to say exactly what it has to do with privacy. It seems to me that the protection of identity is, to the extent that we think that protection of personal information is a harder and harder way to get at privacy values, I think the protection of identity is even that much harder, in that identity is something by definition you use publicly. To me, one of the big questions that comes up in all these different identity management systems from a kind of a technical and management perspective is who controls the assertion of identity, who can take it away from you, who can determine where you can use it, what you leave around when you use it. So to me, the question of identity has a huge amount to do with who controls the underlying environment in which that identity is expressed, certified, et cetera. It strikes me that the one word that almost everyone on this panel has used is transparency over and over again, and you know, it's such a double-edged kind of notion. It's both the big threat and, to me, the big opportunity, actually, in both the privacy and the identity space. So my interest in designing systems, particularly systems that are mandated or encouraged by governments, is that they have this kind of visibility into them, so that you can get at some transparency into the dynamics of control over people's assertion of identity, over how those identity assertions are used by the various parties that are involved with them, and that you can look at them, and you can at least ask questions about whether systems have been used properly, whether they're designed properly, whether they're too exposing, too risky, whatever. I think the experience just in the U.S. with the data breach law in California is relatively extraordinary. That you know you can't pick up a newspaper for more than a week at a time without finding some you know X 100,000 records that were you know left on the sidewalk somewhere through some data breach. And so I think that part of what really ought to be happening in these systems, as we're all in the process of learning how to build them and culturally learning how to use them, is to make sure that the environment is really, really very, very open.
I'd like to save 5 minutes at the end just to consider how we might bridge different ideas. But the next two questions we have are Bill and Ira.
I think I can do mine in about two sentences. There's been a lot of talk about government data collection, and then I think most of Mary's list and of course, Hal's example were in that space. And certainly in Europe, the principles that apply to appropriate data collection and handling are consistent across the public and private sectors, but that hasn't generally been the U.S. model. And I wonder if people have thoughts on, as a normative matter, is that the way it ought to be? In other words, ought it to be consistent? The principles that we think about as being appropriate data collection, should they be the same no matter whether you're talking about a public or a private sector collector?
Well, the two international instruments that I mentioned both apply to the public and the private sector without any distinction. And in Europe, it is the same thing, except that community law does not apply to areas of sovereignty. But in fact, many countries, many member states, when they implemented the directive, just had one law. That's the case in France. You just have one law and some exemptions for law enforcement and national security processing.
And I take it you think that's good. In other words, that the U.S. ought to do the same.
I think it's good because there are two things. Governments are making business with other businesses, with businesses and with citizens. And they also have another area of activity, which is, let's say, law enforcement. And data protection rules should apply to government processing of information, whether it's health, whether it's a census, whether... So there's no reason why there would be a difference, at least at the level of the principles.
Ira?
Yeah, I just had a question for Hal and Danny, because I wasn't entirely clear. I was very intrigued by what you presented, but do you imagine a standard that exposes data to everyone who would query it, or is it restricted in some way? And I ask in part because I was surprised, I guess, that you gave a government example, because I wouldn't see much government willingness to, you know, permit transparency of these types of processes. On the other hand, I see a interesting contrast between rolling out DRM systems, which arguably impose, you know, technical constraints on certain types of sharing, and wonder how you see that versus what you're proposing, which instead uses transparency to impose either, you know, ability to redress or audits that then, you know, allow people to understand what's happening and try to use other techniques for enforcement.
So we started with the government example, frankly, because our thinking on this area really started with the TIA discussions. It started with these questions about very large scale data mining, and the seeming kind of inability to form a kind of a long range public policy perspective on that kind of activity. I think there was a kind of a head in the sand approach that said, "Oh well, let's get rid of that program, and all these problems will somehow go away." And there are many reasons to have gotten rid of that particular program, but the fact that those problems are not, that there's not as much traction on working on those problems, they persist in the discussions of the operation, as you know, of the various transportation, the TSA systems, and the associated Privacy Act notices. I actually think there might be I'm not totally pessimistic about the government accepting some of these kinds of transparency requirements. Certainly, some of the accountability and auditing would have to be done with clever crypto tricks to obscure, you know, various information. I think that there are people in this room who can think through that better than I, but there's certainly ways to provide accountability without disclosing classified information to everyone, and to do it in a reasonably secure way. I think that the simple, the very practical problem of information sharing amongst, what is it, 15 U.S. Intelligence agencies who are as skeptical of each other as we are of them, actually really very, very badly want this kind of rules-based accountability system, because they want to make sure that when they're sharing information, they're not creating for themselves security risks by putting some information in a context where it would create some other risk. And the only way you can really think about that is with this kind of instrumentation with rules. I think, though, that clearly we're going to have to figure out a broader approach, because, as you know, a lot of the information that the government wants to use in this context originates in the private sector, in the commercial world. So to your question, Bill, we're not going to be able to draw a line here. I happen to think it might, as a practical matter, be easier to get the government to do this than to get the private sector to do this, because there's simply more... there's more leverage there right now, given all the interest in government surveillance authority. We seem to have accepted that Google can have all of our email and, you know, everyone else. So I think it may be the wrong target of opportunity, but it is kind of a target of opportunity in designing these systems.
Ben wants to interject.
I just wanted to really briefly get back to your point, Bill. I think that it's precisely in the U.S. where I'm not very optimistic about privacy laws being imposed on the private sector anytime soon, that I think the info card-like technologies really need to be not neutral. They need to be agents for the user, to help the user understand what they're getting into, to help the user understand what other users are getting into, to help the user understand how this compares maybe to European privacy laws, right? To just give the user a lot more power. Because we now have this magic moment of authentication where the user will go, oh, something's going on. Let's use that to restore a little bit of the balance. Anne said yesterday in a private discussion that if you want to buy a book from Amazon and Amazon says, I'd like all these fields from you, and you go, well, I don't really want to give these fields, but I really want that book, so I'll just go ahead and do it. We need to find more and better ways that the software can act on the user's behalf to help reestablish a balance there.
We're actually somewhat out of time, but we do have time tomorrow to have a mashup session on this, and I think that there's great interest in the room in doing so. So I think we should coordinate on that. And I also wanted to give an opportunity for the panelists to say one final thing, possibly with the idea of merging these different ideas, maybe using the OECD type principles in a simplified form to give greater specificity to what the machine expressions of user policies might be, or that kind of idea. So maybe we could just go down the row and each panelist have one sentence if you like.
I think that the basic principles of privacy haven't changed. I think the challenge is understand how to actually implement them well in an environment where, as Hal said, we're not going to be able to sequester little bits of data off by themselves and lock them up as a way of enforcing privacy. But the principles of transparency, accountability, fairness, redress are still the vital principles that the OECD taught us more than 20 years ago.
Yeah, I basically want to say the same thing. And I think the really hard challenge is to build accountability into these systems. It's something that that we can only barely start doing right now.
I think I've said it. The info card-like technology is as an agent for the user. acting on behalf of the user to protect their privacy. I really hope we can do more in that direction to reach the spirit of the internet, of the universal human right of privacy.
Good night and good luck. Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is worth investigating. The two challenges. One is law is not always Boolean, and so sometimes the law and code stuff encounter each other, and we just sort of think about how these principles can be incorporated into systems, but we have to remember there are those limits on it. And as I think some people have said, the results may be more law-oriented, or there may be also some possibilities with code, self-regulation, other ways of making that happen. And there are still, of course, the larger questions that have been raised here that are sort of in the background of the development of these kinds of systems.
I've been for many years in this business of data protection. There are two things. It's not that I am pessimistic, but I'm worried for two reasons. First of all, as Mark prompted earlier, I believe we are changing, our behaviors are changing, prompted by technology. Look at how we are all in a room connected to the internet, doing a lot of different things, listening to people who speak, and the fashion trend that was exposed yesterday. So we are changing. When tomorrow we will be in this more pervasive environment, I don't know how we will be able to apply our traditional data protection rules, which were centered on centralized systems. You have a data controller and you have a number of individuals, but tomorrow everyone is going to be potentially a data controller. So how do you enforce that? That's the major issue. The second one is that I'm not sure that the interests at play for the moment are really weighing in favor of users. Identity management systems are presented like, I'm thinking of the laws of Kim Cameron, which represent a cooperative effort. That's wonderful. You have the impression that you're reading a data protection law, but it's a neutral platform. So when you go online and you say, these are my preferences, and you discuss via a machine with a business which says, no, if you want this book, I want more, what will users do? Where is the balance of power? I think on government side too, I'm not sure that any of the big stakeholders, as we said, the OECD, are ready for the moment to give up with the system, introduce clarity, and really bring this user-centric vision. So once again, any effort that goes in that direction, that helps users have these rights and these values respected, is good. But I don't know, we need the help of those who have the technology in hand if this has to have an impact.
Great. Well, thank you to our five expert panelists. But because all of you in this room are experts as well, I do hope that tomorrow everybody can pool their ideas in some sort of mashup. Thank you.